So I'd like to welcome you all back to the podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. My name is Guy Melrose. There's a great joy in medicine of making a correct diagnosis, and it fills you with a certain amount of professional pride when you manage to make a diagnosis that has a significant effect on somebody's outcome. And sometimes these diagnoses are very obvious and can't be missed. And sometimes they're very subtle. And the more subtle, the more satisfying, I think, when you pick up something that is a little bit subtle, a little bit hidden, a little bit under the radar. And no more so than the condition, the syndrome that we're going to talk about today, because the difference between picking up this condition and not can be sudden death. And so I would like to, first of all, welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Ivan Coe. Ivan trained in urgent care in New Zealand before working in Ireland and is now based in the King's Urgent Care Clinic in London. And he's the convener of the UK and Ireland faculty of the college. And we spoke with Ivan when he was over back in New Zealand last year. Ivan, welcome back to the podcast. Thank you for drawing my attention to this particular case that we're going to talk about today.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to join you again.
And in addition to Ivan, I'd like to welcome Dr. Yusuf, who is an emergency physician. He has worked in emergency medicine for the last decade and a half or so, trained with the Royal College of Emergency Medicine in the UK, and is currently on the advanced training programme for the College of Urgent Care here in New Zealand, under the supervision of Ivan in London. Dr. Yusuf, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure.
Now, Ivan got in touch because he wanted to bring to my attention this particular case, and it was a case that you saw, hence the reason that we've invited you along to talk about it. So let's first of all hear the case from you, how the patient presented, what you diagnosed, and how you disposed of this patient in the urgent care setting, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the syndrome itself. So, Dr. Yusuf, over to you to tell us about your case.
Yeah, thank you, Guy. I had a patient. This was a recent event. I had a 55-year-old gentleman who walked into the urgent care. He is presenting with complaints of chest pain. So he describes the pain as retrosternal burning pain, which was going on and off for a week already. Describes pain last for 20 minutes or less. When he presented to urgent care, he was asymptomatic. His all observations were all fine. He had an ECG in triage, and I've seen him immediately as he was placed on red priority. He was, when I was examining him, he was pain-free, and his last pain was that morning, which brought him here. Past medical history-wise, there's nothing significant. He's a chronic smoker, otherwise nil significant. On examination, NAD, nothing significant. And ECG was interesting. It was a sinus rhythm with a deep T-wave, symmetrical deep T-wave inversion from V2 to V4. So that's the case. And he was matching up with all other criteria for a proximal LAD obstruction, which is Welin syndrome. He was not having any ongoing pain, and there was no Q wave pattern in the ECG. So deep T wave inversion, I could recognize that is a proximal LAD obstruction. So he needs to go to A&E. He will need a monitored, he need to go to a place where he can be monitored. He will need serial ECGs. So I had a discussion with the A&E consultant who accepted this patient, and he was taken straight away to the A&E for further treatment and investigations.
So Wellens syndrome, as you mentioned, it's an eponymous syndrome named after Hein Wellens, who was a Dutch cardiologist who wrote about it in 1982, and he died sadly in 2020. Reading his biography, and the reason that this rung a bell when you and Ivan raised it with me is that the criteria for the Wellens syndrome is on the ECG they can have this these T wave changes, these inverted biphasic T waves, typically in V2 to 3, but can be anywhere between 1 and 6. But the real kicker for me was that it's usually in somebody who's pain-free and often will have normal cardiac enzyme markers as well. And so when you put all those things together, you think, well, this could be somebody who could be erroneously sent home. And in fact, they've got almost, this is a sign of an almost complete LAD obstruction, occlusion, and so it's the sort of stenosis that that results in sudden death. So so by picking it up, Yusuf, you were able to obviously refer them, and prevent that outcome. And so it was a great pickup on the ECG. If I bring in Ivan now, Ivan, you've got memories, I guess, from a while back of a case that didn't go so well. Are you happy to just sort of vaguely talk around that particular case?
Sure. Yeah. So I had some, and that the first time I ever came across it was the fact that I saw this patient again in mid-50s, had some burning type retrosternal chest pain that was then became pain-free. And I was working in the emergency department at the time. We did an ECG that showed these deep T-wave inversions. So we kept him in with all the resources that we have of the emergency department, obviously. Then we repeated an ECG, which then turned out normal. He had two serial troponins done, which both were normal. And there was nothing else sort of abnormal on there. So it was kind of in the middle of the night. And so I took it on myself as one of the registrars there to send him home. Unfortunately, he came back in VF arrest, but thankfully we managed to actually resuscitate him. And he then went to the cath lab, had his LAD stented, and was able to obviously make a good recovery. And that sort of stuck in my mind, and has stuck in my mind since. And so with these sort of syndromes, and it's a very, very classical pattern that you can actually see, that you can, if you're not aware of it, then obviously miss. But when you are aware of it, something that sort of sticks in your mind, and then you know what to do about them.
Yeah, so thank you both for sharing those two cases, because the criteria, as I mentioned before, and you can find this all over the place, the Life in the Fast Lane has a good page, but deeply inverted or biphasic T waves in V2 to 3, usually in the pain-free state, and that's one of the key take-homes for me, is that you can't be reassured by a pain-free patient in this setting. Isoelectric or minimally elevated ST segments, so below criteria for ST elevation, less than a millimeter, no precordial Q waves, preserved precordial R wave progression, but they've got to have had a recent history of angina type pain, and often normal or minimally elevated serum cardiac markers, and that's the criteria for the Wellens syndrome. So the key part of this, I guess, is recognizing the ECG is the key thing, and all urgent care clinics have an ECG machine, so we should be obviously doing these and looking for them. But the thing I wanted to get onto here was that normalization of the T waves can occur as well, and so that's another trap that we could be falling into. So Yusuf, did your patient have any signs of normalization of the T wave on ECG?
Okay, I think saying normalization is actually misleading. I think it is pseudo normalization. It's not a normalization, actually. I think the right word is pseudo normalization. Yeah, because the patients with proximal LED obstruction, they have this reperfusion pattern. So what is a biphasic T inversion? That is always a, you know, it's a reperfusion pattern. So they don't have any pain when they reperfuse. So when they have a pain, they, I mean, their myocardium is ischemic, probably injured, but not infarcted. So, you know, the first change you usually see in an ECG with an impending infarction or, you know, with an impending injury is a T wave changes. It may be in a hyperacute T. So what we are seeing as a pseudo normalization is likely the patient is having injury, myocardial injury at the time, and he gets reperfused and it go back to a, you know, biphasic T wave pattern when they are pain free. And when they are in pain, we see a normal upright T wave, which is actually not normal. It's a pseudo normalization. Well, in this patient, answering your question, I didn't see that pattern because he was pain free. If I would have taken an ECG on this patient when he was in pain, I would have seen probably an upright T wave, which, you know, which will falsely reassure me that everything is normal. And if I have done a troponin at that time, it would be again normal, probably. So, you know, that this is, you know, real. There are a lot of pitfalls in balance. No, this patient have not seen a normalization, pseudo normalization.
Yeah, that's a good point. So a pseudo normalization. So again, something that's going to lull us into a false sense of security and trick us, but the trick is in obviously identifying those T wave changes in the context of those other diagnostic criteria and the history. And so your case, Yusuf, was you were in an urgent care that's quite close to an emergency department, to an A&E in the UK, so you were able to refer that patient quite easily, and you didn't get any pushback when you said Wellens syndrome. Presumably that creates the right sort of red flag to make the referral easier. Is that the case?
Yes. Because his ECG and his kind of presentation meet all the criteria which is mentioned for a Wellens. Luckily, I didn't find any resistance from the A&E team. They easily accepted this patient because there's no argument here. So, and I was luckily able to speak to a senior consultant who readily accepted this patient. So I could take him straight away there.
And Ivan, just putting your hat, your New Zealand hat back on and thinking about the New Zealand urgent care context, if you were to see a Wellens syndrome ECG in an urgent care clinic in a slightly less urbanized area, maybe a little bit more remote, how would you recommend our urgent care fellows here in New Zealand approach this particular case?
So in those situations, I think you'd still need to transfer them to a center for definitive management. It could still be your local emergency department in the first instance. So ambulance transfer, priority one ambulance to actually get them to the local emergency department. And then if there is a cath labs available in that sort of setting, then allow the emergency physicians in that instance to actually sort that bit out. But from our point of view, from an urgent care point of view, it is getting them into a hospital of sorts with its adequate resources to be able to deal with things. They need to be transferred, monitored fully in that situation.
And it would be like the highest priority ambulance because of the, as I mentioned at the start there, this is a precipitous diagnosis. You're standing right on top of that cliff, and there's no time really between being well and then being very unwell. There isn't much of a sliding scale there. So being cautious and stating priority one to the ambulance, to 111 is important. And I think that kind of made me think also about this role within things like the accelerated chest pain pathway. This would obviously be missed if you considered the ECG normal and you did troponins. You know, it would therefore come out normal, but actually the pathway is still valid because the pathway requires a normal ECG to kind of commence down that pathway. So actually you fall off that pathway because it's an abnormal ECG. So why is this something that's easily missed? Maybe Yusuf, go to you first, and then I'll hear Ivan's thoughts. Why is this ECG considered to be normal? Is it the pseudo-normalization that tricks us, or is it just something that what are we overlooking to call it a normal ECG and to go down those other chest pain pathways?
Both the pseudo normalization and the biphasic T waves, I think in its early stages, it's really it can mislead the clinicians, especially when you do an ECG and the patient is having an ongoing pain. You get a ECG which looks normal because the T waves is upright and everything looks fine. And he got no pain after a few minutes. You send a blood, your troponin comes back, most likely normal. And you have one ECG with normal upright T waves, and you have a normal troponin, and patient is pain-free. So here, you miss it if you don't do another ECG when he's pain-free, which if he's having a proximal LAD obstruction, you will see a reperfusion pattern, which is biphasic T-wave inversion or maybe a symmetrical T-wave inversion later on. And if you don't have much awareness of this condition, and if this is the situation, you can miss this pattern. Again, if you see the other situation where patient present pain-free state and you have a biphasic T-wave inversion and you have a normal troponin, and if you're not much aware of the situation, patient is pain-free. So you can misdiagnose it, actually. It happened. It happened with me as well. My first ever case I have ever seen, I misdiagnosed it. So this can happen. So there should be good awareness about this condition, and clinicians should know the criteria how to diagnose this. And there are a lot of other mimics, which looks like there are lookalike valence, which is also, you know, confusing to the physicians.
Yeah, the mimics are always a problem, but I guess just bringing it into an urgent care context, that's not our job to determine those, is it? If we've got concern, it could be Wellens. We need to be referring and let a cardiologist decide that it isn't. We don't take those chances, I guess, in our setting. I agree with you. It's the awareness is the key thing, so that we're always looking. Any comments, Ivan, on why the ECG might be considered normal, or people might gloss over it and move on to the reassurance of pain-free and troponins normal in these settings?
I think, as what Yusuf said, it's the lack of awareness about these patterns and not recognizing the patterns as the key thing. The fact that there are no ST changes, or the ST segments don't look elevated, don't look depressed, which are the two sort of normal classical things that we look for, then gives us that false sense of security and false sense of reassurance that everything's okay. And especially because it's only in these V leads, or the precordial leads of 2, 3, and 4 classically as well. So if you're not seeing any other changes in the limb leads or anywhere else, then that gives you, again, that false sense of security that everything looks okay. The only other thing to add is that in the literature, it does say in several places that these patients are not to be stress tested either. So for those people that may have rapid access to a chest pain clinic that does stress test, then stress testing a patient with Wellens is actually can prove to be have detrimental outcomes as well.
And I think certainly nowadays we've got the ability to send images, pretty good images, to people for review. So this might be, if there's any doubt, we should be recommending our urgent care physicians to be taking a copy of the ECG and sending it to a cardiologist for them to give a second opinion if you've got any doubt about it. Because the key thing is, if you think about it, you're not going to miss it. You may start seeing it where it isn't. And as I said before, that's for a cardiologist to then decide. But it's much better that you're thinking of it and maybe over-diagnosing it in the odd occasion than under-diagnosing it. And so certainly I would encourage people to always consider phoning a cardiologist for advice and either sending a photo or however you can share the imaging, the image of the ECG remotely with a specialist. And on that point, I don't know if either of you have been seeing the sort of evolution of AI technology in identifying signs of myocardial occlusion. There's something I've been seeing online, the Queen of Hearts study, which is an AI diagnostic tool for ECGs to pick up on early signs of myocardial occlusion. So do either of you have any thoughts on AI, in the future of AI in recognizing ECGs?
So I'll actually be covering one of those in an upcoming Journal of Urgent Care Medicine abstracts. So look out for that.
Wow.
But I have actually seen... But I have actually seen the evolution of it in the States in the urgent care conference that I attended last year, where with minimal leads, they can actually, so rather than the normal 12 leads that we place, there is this system that's on the market now where with 5 leads, it can actually do a complete 16 lead ECG, including posterior leads. And the AI can then sort of predict with pretty good accuracy these days. But there is obviously increased sensitivity as the software and the AI gets improves in the way that it obviously learns things. That means that, yeah, that we may come to a point where AI might be actually helping us identify patients that are at higher risk. And then obviously earmarking them for further referrals and investigations.
I didn't realize that you were that wasn't a shameless plug. I wasn't aware that you were going to be bringing this up, Ivan. But now is a good time to mention that you do you edit the abstracts of urgent care in the Journal of Urgent Care Medicine, and I'd recommend everybody who works in urgent care to look at those every month, because you bring papers together and you look at it through the relevance to urgent care, and it's a quick and easy read, and then you can dive deeper into the papers if you want. So I'm going to look out with interest to see what papers you've got on that, because it's certainly interesting to me to think that in the future we could be using an AI technology to identify these sorts of subtle changes within an ECG, such that we don't miss out on a serious impending diagnosis. Yusuf, have you had any run-ins with AI ECG interpretation and anything like that?
Not yet. I'm yet to experience that, but this all sounds very promising.
And I think it's what I was always told when an ECG was handed to me is you shouldn't look at the little interpretation on top of it, because for years now, ECG machines have done a little bit of interpretation, and that still holds true. I think you should be interpreting the ECG yourself and not relying on the machine to do it. But this evolution of AI seems to be the next level, and the studies do look promising. And just on that, Yusuf, was the ECG that you did it contain one of those sort of self machine interpretations? And if it did it pick up anything, or was this purely your brain power that identified the abnormality?
To be honest, I didn't look at it because I never read an interpretation on what is written on ECG, because sometimes
You're
it
well
can
trained.
be misleading. It can cause bias in our own interpretation. So I make a habit of not reading it. So no, I have not looked at it. There was a reading, I remember, because yeah, it is there.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that you don't want to be falsely reassured. And this just again feeds back to that message, is that when looking at an ECG in somebody who's had chest pain, if you're thinking Wellens syndrome and you're looking at those precordial leads and you're looking for those biphasic changes, you're not as likely to miss it if you're always looking for it. And Ivan, years ago you had that negative outcome. Well, the patient survived, which was good, but it was obviously a case that you learned significantly from. And Yusuf, you've obviously picked this up recently, so it's at the forefront of your mind. But it's something that all of our urgent care clinicians should be very much aware of. So as we wrap things up, Ivan, first, do you have any sort of summary or take home message for people listening, apart from to subscribe to the Journal of Urgent Care Abstracts for ongoing CPD? Any other messages for people?
I think technology will start to become our friend in this space. I think I'm looking forward to what evolves over the next sort of 3, 4, 5 years. And so hopefully that will actually give us aids to help our busy sort of jobs be a little bit easier. And if technology does do well in this space, then it'll actually help us a lot in terms of appreciating the subtleties of certain things that, maybe the human eye is not able to fully appreciate.
And Yusuf, any take-home learnings that you want to stress to the listeners relating to Wellens syndrome?
So look out for Wellens in all chest pain-free patients. It is very, very, tricky at times. Look for the criterias. Don't be assured with the normal troponins. That's what I learned from all my Wellens, which I have encountered. So look out for these things.
Yeah, and certainly I thank you both for raising this topic. I've certainly learned and reflected on practice through reading around this, and I think that what you've said there about the normal troponins and the potential for that kind of pseudo-normalization reassurance, I think goes back to a lot of those pathways. You can go down a chest pain pathway, but they all start with a normal ECG, and it's making sure we don't call this a normal ECG at the start and then go down and do those serial troponins and the like. So we need to be doing the due diligence on the first ECG and also doing some serial ones as necessary to look for any of those changes. And as soon as those T waves start to do anything kind of a little bit dodgy looking, then if in doubt, I think we should be involving cardiology for an opinion, either via a telehealth type assessment of the ECG, or if in doubt, I think this is one of those cases where you err on the side of caution because there isn't a safety net really for this particular condition. With something serious like sepsis, for example, you can send someone home with infection with a safe se sepsis safety net, such that when they start to deteriorate, they come back and you pick up sepsis a little bit earlier on that spectrum. This to me doesn't seem like it has that kind of spectrum. It's more of an on and off switch, and the person is going to go from being fine to being dead very quickly. And so the safety netting can't be relied upon with this. So when in that situation, it's a case of referring and let a cardiologist tell you that this is not Wellens syndrome, rather than taking a chance. So I think it may sound overly cautious, but we are literally dealing with that kind of on-off situation. So I would encourage everybody to look out for this, but also not to take any chances. If it's on your mind, speak to a cardiologist and get the patient assessed elsewhere. So thank you both for raising this and for talking on the podcast. I say it often, if anyone has any interesting cases or an area of interest they want to talk about, you can email podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz. And I think these are the sorts of things that talking about them in this context helps to raise that awareness that hopefully will mean that we'll pick up on these cases going forwards, and kind of like a big peer group. You know, when you share your cases at a peer group, what you're doing is you're disseminating your experiences amongst other people, so that some rarer conditions are encountered by us all by proxy. And so this is kind of what we're doing with the podcast, raising that awareness for everybody. So do please share your cases and any area of interest with us, just like Ivan and Yusuf have today. So thank you, Ivan, as always, and thank you for your work with the Journal of Urgent Care. It's great. And thank you, Yusuf, for talking to us today, and good luck with completing your accelerated pathway to fellowship with the college. And I wish you all the best in your future urgent care careers.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Guy.